Hi, this is Laura Resnick. I'm the author of the Esther Diamond series, and you're listening to the SF Signal podcast.
This is the Parsec-nominated SF Signal podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name's Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. Today's episode is an interview. I sat down with prolific author Laura Resnick. Laura is the author of numerous short stories and books, including the Esther Diamond series from DAW. We did have a little technical difficulty with Laura's phone, and I think I cut all that out, but if you do happen to hear a sudden beep that makes you think you're on your phone and someone's pushing buttons, I do apologize. It's just something weird that started happening to her phone. Okay. So, Laura Resnick, short stories, books, Esther Diamond. Here we go. Let's jump right in. And tonight on the line, I have award-winning author Laura Resnick. Hi, Laura.
Hi there.
How's it going?
Fine.
How are things in, is it Ohio?
Yeah, here in Ohio, fine.
You know, one of my favorite comedians is Ron White, and he tells a terrible, terrible joke about Cincinnati chili.
Oh, which is like a sacred food here, so we don't joke about that.
I know, and that's kind of the point. He says, you know, he flew into Cincinnati, and there's all these signs about how it's the chili capital of the world. And he's like, well, did anybody tell anybody in Mexico?
Well, we don't really do what most people consider chili. It's more of kind of a, it's a kind of a dark sauce with meat in it, and the recipe is secret, and everyone has their own opinions about it. Like, some people put chocolate in it, some people put cardamom, most people put cinnamon, so it doesn't really taste like what you think of as chili. And then it's served over spaghetti noodles,
yep.
And on top of that, you put onions, grated cheddar cheese or Colby cheese, and crumbled oyster crackers.
I actually do some of that here. I do spaghetti with the chili on top, homemade chili, and then cheese, and I serve that to folks, and mm-hmm. They seem to like it.
Yeah, and actually, it was funny. I was speaking out in Colorado last year, and there was somebody there who had used to live in Cincinnati, and one of the first things he said to me is, oh, I miss Skyline Chili. And I have a friend who's a writer in Baltimore, Mary Jo Putney, who comes here once in a while to speak or visit or whatever. And one of the stops we have to hit is Skyline Chili, because ever since I introduced her to it, now she loves it.
Oh, boy. There you go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that I've made all the listeners hungry,
yeah,
let's talk a little bit about you. Now, for the sake of our listeners, why don't you tell folks who Laura is and what Laura does?
I am a writer. I'm a fantasy writer mostly. I write an urban fantasy series called the Esther Diamond series, which is published by DAW Books. The fourth book is coming, and the series is coming out this year, Vampirazzi. The last book in it was Unsympathetic Magic, and DAW recently signed for two more books in the series. I have also written traditional fantasy, great big fat books, swords and sorcery, epic stuff for Tor Books. I've written a lot of short stories. I write a monthly column for Novelist Inc., which is an organization of professional novelists. I started my career as a romance writer under the pseudonym Laura Leone, and I published 14 romance novels before I moved over to fantasy. So I've been writing professionally for about 22 or 23 years, something like that.
I
started when I was a zygote, obviously.
I saw you at World Fantasy. You were on a panel, I believe. Mm-hmm. Talking about, was it humor and fantasy?
Yeah, we were talking about writing comedy. The Esther Diamond series is a comedy series, and two other writers were there as well, who also write comedically, and talking about the different challenges and rewards in comedy.
And what I find interesting is humor in fantasy is more accepted, I think, than humor in science fiction.
I think that's fairly new. I actually first tried to sell the Esther Diamond series around, gosh, it was around 1995, was when I wrote the series proposal and tried to sell it. And at that time, you couldn't sell urban fantasy, and in fantasy, you couldn't sell comedy. And in fact, my agent at the time was representing another writer who had a fantasy series that was comedy that had been pretty popular for a while, and they couldn't sell it anymore because comedy had just so gone out of fashion in fantasy. And for a number of years, you know, this was always a series I just thought, this is so much what I should be writing. So many of these elements are just so perfect for me. And I wanted for years, I just kept it in my trunk, hoping I could find an opportunity for it. And even after urban fantasy started getting popular, comedy still wasn't. I mean, it really took me a long time to find the right market for this material. I think now it has become comedy and urban fantasy both quite popular, but these things come and go in cycles and trends, and it just all depends on what editors think they can sell. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. And, of course, it always follows that same old golden goose pattern of publishing, that for a while nobody will buy a thing, and then somebody, some publisher, is the first to discover it works. And as a friend of mine says, no publisher ever wants to be the first to discover that something works, because publishers are risk-averse. And being the first implies there was risk involved. Everybody wants to be the second, because it's still very profitable, but you haven't incurred any risk. But then, you know, something is proved to be, you know, popular and successful, and then publishers completely oversupply and overflood the market with it and just put out way too much of the exact same thing. And some people will say, and they also put a lot of mediocre quality out there. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I think that's in the eye of the beholder. What I do think they always do is put out way too much of a certain thing. They always wind up exceeding the existing audience. You see them do this with erotica, with, you know, big tree killer epic fantasy. I think they're doing it now with urban fantasy, though I say that as an urban fantasy writer. I think they're probably doing it with steampunk. They certainly did it with romantic comedy. I think they must be doing it with vampire books. Surely people are tired of vampires. So that happens, and then, you know, each individual title starts making almost no money, because there's just way too many titles out there in a particular subgenre or fashionable trend. And then publishers come to think, well, this kind of book doesn't make money anymore, and eventually they stop acquiring it. And for a few years, that type of book has the reputation of not making money. And then at some point, you know, the trend has now moved on to some other form of book. I remember after, what's her name, the woman who wrote Deep End of the Ocean, which was a really, really huge best-selling thriller about a kidnapped child. This actually started a trend for a while of kidnapped child books, oh, of boy. All things. So, you know, nobody likes a trend like a publishing house. But fortunately, I found a house that, Daw Books, I don't think they're very trend-oriented at all. They look for writers they really like and think they want to keep for a long time. And they really like the series, so...
Well, that's awesome. And when is the fourth book coming out?
It's coming out in October. It's called Vampirazzi, and I refer to it as a vampire book for people like me who are just so sick of vampires.
Well, you know what? Obviously, your last name is Resnick. I have chatted with your dad a couple times, and one of the things that he said that absolutely cracked me up was he said, you know, when did vampires become sexy? He said they used to
that's
be these...
One of the things-
these undead, unclean things that wanted to kill you.
That's one of the things I wondered all along, because I didn't even know he thought that. It's not something we've discussed, but that's exactly what I think. And this is discussed in Vampirazzi, along with a lot of other things. Like, how does this become sexy? But I will say, it's so funny, because when I delivered the book, my editor, Betsy Wolheim, who I'm very much on the same page with about how we see the series and how we want the books to go, she wrote me her comments, and she had a couple of concerns, like, you know, how do you think people are going to react to this or that? They were totally different than my concerns. One of my concerns is there is a bit in there where one of the characters says, you know, unclean, blah, 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 why is this sexy? When did this become erotic? And I actually just jokingly said something like that 2 or 3 years ago, before I even ever knew I would write this book. I said something like that in front of a bunch of writers. Several of them, who I think must be writing vampire books, got really offended, and there's at least one of them who I don't know if to this day that person is speaking to me.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So, clearly, there are strong feelings about this. I wouldn't even say I have strong feelings about it. It's more like my feelings are, I just don't get it. So...
So you've got the urban fantasy. You've also done the epic fantasy. Tell us a little bit about that.
I did an epic fantasy trilogy for Tor Books, and that just sort of evolved. There was actually something in Sicilian history. I used to live in Sicily, the southernmost province of Italy. And there were some historical events there that are very, very well known that just really captivated me, and I had wanted to do a book about it, but it just didn't really quite work until I thought, oh, if you translate this into a fantasy novel, you can change the parts of the historical thing that were really pretty anticlimactic and just don't work in fiction, and write your own version and sort of go on from there. And I showed it to my then agent, who was a science fiction and fantasy agent, who really liked it and gave me some good advice about the market at the time, which was nobody was buying short books anymore. You had to come up with something that was, you know, just massive, a tree killer. And so I reworked it a little bit and was really pleased and very happy with what I came up with, and we got a pretty good deal for it, and it turned into a trilogy, which I really enjoyed writing. My feelings about it, there are one, just writing a manuscript that's a 1,000 pages, boy, does that kill a lot of brain cells. I did it pretty well, I think, but I just felt it was something I didn't really feel I wanted to make, I want to make a whole career of. As it happens, not long afterwards, the kind of the pressure, when I sold those, it was really hard to sell anything that wasn't at least, you know, 200 or 250,000 words in fantasy. I kept saying, I'd really like to sell something that's only about 100,000 words. That's a really good length for me. And my then editor and then agent were both just very negative about that idea. Mm. Everybody was looking for the great big, you know, doorstop or tree killer things. Fortunately, that kind of changed, and most people want fairly shorter books now, in part just because production costs made that trend pretty expensive for publishers after a while. And also, I think readers started feeling, you know, it was the same thing. The market got overflooded, and I think even readers started thinking, you know, I'd really like to read something that doesn't take up 4 months of my life now and then.
You know, one of my favorite series is the Dresden books, mm-hmm. and those are quick. I mean, you can read those in just a couple of nights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not a fast reader. You would actually have to, like, sit me down at gunpoint to make me read a book as big as the books I wrote for tour, because it would take up 4 months of my life. I'm not a fast reader for whatever reason. So as a reader, occasionally there is a book that's so good that's at 200 or 300,000 words, you don't care how long it is. You just want to stick with that book. But for the most part, I mean, I really have to be passionate about a book as a reader to want to stick with it for weeks at a time, which is how long it takes me to read a book that's 300,000 words. And I like a book that, you know, I start it today and I'll be finished by the end of the weekend.
Wow. You don't just do novels, you also do short fiction.
Yeah, although it's ironic, I don't think of myself as a short story writer, but I've actually sold over 60 short stories.
Wow.
Almost all of them, I think all but one or two of those were on commission. They were almost all of them for Marty Greenberg, John Helfers, Denise Little, and Larry Seagriff of Techno Books. And in almost every instance, either those guys or an editor who was working with them, sometimes it was my dad or Jennifer Robertson or Daniel Hoyt or any number of people who work with them, sends out an invitation, invites writers into an anthology, and gives you a theme. And if you give me a theme, if you say, I want a short story about, I don't know, dragons, or about time travel, or, you know, alternate presidencies, or whatever, if you give me a theme, I can come up with a short story. But I don't have short story ideas on my own. I think of myself as a novelist, and I think the key difference, at least for me, from my perspective, is what I really think of in terms of story is I think of characters and character development and character conflicts and relationship and a protagonist or set of main characters who go through story arcs in which they change and grow and develop and confront their demons and come to a resolution at the end. That's not really a great set of themes for a short story for 20 pages or 15 pages or something. I'm not really an ideas writer who think, oh, I have this great abstract idea I want to write about. I think about, you know, an individual or set of individuals who are then going to go through all of these things to develop further as people, whether it's comedy or drama. And that doesn't really go hand in hand with short stories. And I've actually been fretting about this all day because I owe a short story to an anthology where the editor didn't give us a theme or even a genre. It's sort of a fundraiser, and he just said, you know, yeah, write me something just about 5,000 words. And I have no idea what to do if I'm not given a theme, because I'm just not a short story writer in that sense.
Cthulhu worshipping zombie unicorns from Mars.
Okay, thank you. That'll help.
You know, I have a lot of respect for people who can crank out 5,000 words and have it as a complete story.
Well, if it's not a complete story, then why would anyone read it? You know, that sort of goes with the job.
It does, but you know, there's a language to the short story. You know, there's the use of vocabulary. It has to be precise.
Well, I don't know. I guess there we're getting sort of academic and abstract. I have no idea. This is one of the reasons I don't, I really don't teach writing or teach writing workshops or do writing workshops or talk about writing. I don't know. I know you give me a theme and I know, okay, I've got to come up with something that is a full circle that has a beginning, a middle, and an end and a point, and it's going to have to fit into about 15 or 20 manuscript pages, and that's just what I do. If it has a different sort of language, I really have no idea.
When did you start writing?
I was 24 years old, 23 or 24 years old.
Wow, so just couple years ago.
I was living in Sicily at the time, and I had an overdraft at Barclays Bank that I was trying to pay off, and I wasn't going to be able to pay it off on what I was earning. I was teaching English in Sicily, and I thought, well, what could I do in my spare time that I might be able to earn, like, you know, say $3,000 and pay this off? And I happened to read a book called How to Write a Romance and Get It Published, which somebody had mentioned to me. And I was really pursuing it as, well, maybe this might be one possible way to deal with this. Not really so much out of a very, I'll be honest, a keen interest in writing or in romance novels. I was just looking to pay off my overdraft. So that was one of the things I was looking at. And I read this book and thought, well, you know, a short novel about two likable people who fall in love, I think I could do that maybe. So I had this old manual typewriter that I think it was Italian, so it had the keys in all the wrong places. So typing was very slow. And paper there in those days, this was in the 80s, it was a different size than the paper here. So my word count was way off because my sheets of paper were longer. And I came up with an idea for a book. I wrote the whole thing by hand, and I would edit by hand because when you're on an old manual typewriter with keys in the wrong place, once you've typed it, it's set in stone. I was never going to retype a single page of that. And that was how I wrote my first couple of books. Just I targeted a specific market. In those days, it was Silhouette Books, which is owned by Harlequin, and it's called it's a subgenre called category romance. It's what people are thinking of when they talk about, you know, formulaic romances all packaged alike and so on. That's a small part of the genre, in the way that media tie-in is a small part of the science fiction genre, but it tends to get pegged by people who don't know anything about romance as the whole genre, in the way that I guess Star Trek gets pegged by people who don't know anything about science fiction as the whole genre. So anyhow, that was the market I was targeting. And this was so emblematic of how my career would go thereafter. I was living over in Sicily. This was pre-internet. So I shipped a dozen query packages to literary agents by transatlantic surface mail. And all 12 of the literary agents responded by saying either, you know, forget about it, you have no talent, you'll never sell, or forget about it, the romance genre is dead, write something else. The romance genre at the time was the best-selling, best-earning genre in publishing, and it has pretty much continued to be so for the succeeding 20 years. And that was my first view, that just because someone's title is literary agent, it doesn't actually mean they know anything at all about the publishing industry. So the same two books, with all these which all these literary agents had told me were unsaleable, I sold both of them that same year to Silhouette. And it really wasn't until after I'd made that first sale that it even occurred to me I could kind of go on with this and make a career of it. I was really looking to pay off my overdraft at Berkeley's Bank. And then at some point, I guess it was after the first sale, and the editor said, you know, we really like your work. We'd really like to buy more books from you. Are you still writing? And I was, because I had grown up in a writer's house, so I knew that perseverance is the single most important quality a writer can have. And my plan was I would write 6 complete books and just keep sending them out. And I would have to complete 6 books before I would even start to reassess and say, well, is this really working? Should I just give up? Should I keep going? What'll I do? That I wasn't planning to stop until I had written six. So I had a couple of more manuscripts, although I think one of them sold and one of them never did. But I had several manuscripts ready by the time I made my first sale. And that was kind of how I got started.
Did you ever feel any pressure growing up in a writer's house to kind of follow in the footsteps?
Oh, God, quite the opposite. No, no. For one thing, I didn't want to write, and I have tried a couple of times to quit. Just because growing up in a writer's house, you see what sort of a lifestyle it is, and I didn't want that lifestyle. And I don't think my parents wanted it for me. So there was never any suggestion that I should become a writer or might consider it. I had no interest in it, and it wasn't really what my parents wanted for me either. So not at all. I mean, there were friends of the family and that sort of thing who thought I would write, but I said no way. And I think my parents just blew that off as well. And I really didn't set out when I started writing in my mid-20s. It wasn't at the time a career plan, like I said. So, no, quite the opposite.
So you've written in a lot of different genres. You've used pseudonyms for different genres that you've written in. You know, what's your perspective on how the industry is changing now with the ebook market? That seems to be rising. The print book seems to be declining. Sales are off. What is your take?
Well, I have to say, first of all, I've actually only written under one pseudonym. Laura Leone was for my romance name. Everything else I've ever written, I've done under my own name.
So I thought I saw another one. I'm sorry.
Not that I can remember, no, but I have a bad memory. I did actually do some like bizarre work for hire for somebody in Florida once under a name I don't even remember, and I also didn't save what I wrote. But I doubt I would have ever mentioned that because I don't even remember the name. But
gotcha.
No, just the two names.
Okay.
My perspective on the industry, well, that's a huge question. It's like, what's my perspective on democracy? I think that, you know, obviously the industry is in a big state of flux and change. I am very skeptical about anyone who answers that question with predictions by saying they know what's going to happen. I'm like, oh, yeah, right. You've got a crystal ball. You know all. It always reminds me of the Foundation trilogy, which I never took seriously. I know, and probably now people are turning off their podcast saying, well, she's an idiot. She's a Philistine. But I read Foundation, and I thought, oh, please, you don't know that this is going to happen, which is pretty much how I feel whenever people sit around predicting ebooks that or where the industry's going or what's going to happen to publishers. I think there are a lot of possibilities, and it could go in a number of different directions. I, for one, think that although there will always be publishers opening up and publishers going out of business, I don't think publishing companies are going to disappear any more than music companies have disappeared. We have also not seen film companies or studios or television production companies disappear. I don't know why people are predicting our industry will be unique in that the major companies that deliver content will disappear. I think we'll see, you know, more of a long tail of a range of providers, everything from the individual self-publishing all the way up to these, you know, huge international conglomerations like Penguin and Random House. I think that they will all continue existing. I think the nature of what they do will keep changing and their relationships will keep changing. Certainly for a writer, the great benefit of the changes in the industry are that you never again need to waste work. For a writer, it's always been if you write a full manuscript or you write a full proposal, a full proposal being, let's say, anywhere from 50 to 100 pages for a new project. It used to be that if you couldn't sell it, that was wasted work. Because what were you going to do with it now? If you couldn't sell it to a publisher, it wasn't going to go any further. And that need never again be the case. You always have the option now of finishing that book and self-publishing it and earning from it or trying to earn from it, which I think is terrific for anybody who has ever, as all of us have at one point or another, encountered that really frustrating thing of an editor saying, well, you know, we love this book, but we don't know how to market it, so we're not going to buy it. And nobody needs to deal with that anymore. And I think that's very freeing for writers and a terrific boon.
Absolutely. Well, I'm coming up on our time together here. I've really appreciated, you know, talking to you. This has been a great conversation. Why don't you tell folks, are you doing any conventions, any signings, any appearances anywhere?
No, I hate people, so I don't go out that much. I work really, really hard. So honestly, I work really hard. So when I'm not working, most of the time, if I actually have 4 or 5 days and some free money, I want to go on vacation or go visit my friends or something like that. A convention just feels like more work most of the time because everybody's talking about the same stuff that I already do full time. So I know a lot of writers, they love going to conventions and that's their fun time. To me, I just feel like, God, I came here to get away from work and that won't be possible now. So I don't go to very few conventions. I don't really know if I'm going to anything at all before WorldCon in 2012, which I'm going to because my dad is guest of honor.
Okay. And that's going to be in Chicago.
Yep. And like I said, I don't know that I'm going to go to anything before then.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell people about your website, where they can find you online, if you do any Twitter or any of that kind of stuff?
Well, I don't Twitter because I refuse to do anything that's called tweeting. I just don't see that. I'm on Facebook, Laura Resnick, and my website is lauraresnick.com. And I don't blog. When my publisher asked me if I blog, I said, well, no, because just blathering on is so much easier than writing a novel. All I would do is post blog posts all day. I'd never write another word of fiction. And they said, okay, don't blog. We don't want you to have a blog in that case. Don't do it. So no blog, just a website and Facebook and very few public appearances. I never do signings because you just sit there with a fixed smile on your face for 2 hours wishing somebody would buy a book.
Alrighty, well, I appreciate you coming on tonight.
Thank you for inviting me, and I'm sorry my phone service wasn't so good.
Oh, that's okay. Hopefully, you know, folks will go out, they'll check out your website, maybe they'll grab a couple of your books off Amazon, and...
Whoop, there it goes again. All right, I'm going to get off the phone.
All righty. Well, thanks again for coming on. I had a lot of fun. I hope you did too.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And there you have it, our interview with Laura Resnick. Hope everybody goes and checks out her stuff. This summer, SF Signal is joining forces with the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing and Mer Lafferty's I Should Be Writing podcasts to bring you a unique trivia contest / giveaway. Sponsored by Pyre, we have 12 books to give away to 6 winners who will be selected at random from eligible entries. Books that you could win include the Buntline Special from Mike Resnick. You may recognize that name from earlier in the podcast there. Sasha by Joel Shepard. The Strange Affair of Spring-Heeled Jack by Mark Hoder. Hoder. I don't know. They should give me a pronunciation guide. For every book, every author, a pronunciation guide. Diving the Wreck and City of Ruins by Christine Catherine Roush, and The Falling Machine, The Society of Steam, Book 1 by Andrew P. Mayer, to name just a few. Now, we've already given you our trivia question. If you didn't catch it, you need to rewind a couple of episodes, because we did give it to you already. But you need all 3 questions and the answers to enter the contest. So go check out Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing and I Should Be Writing. Both of those are podcasts. Listen to them. Listen for their questions. And then, you know, stick around because they're great podcasts. Collect the answers to all 3 trivia questions and submit them to adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com by midnight on Friday, July 22nd. Please include your name, address, and phone number with your entry. The phone number will only be used in case of technical difficulties with your email address. Due to copyright restrictions, this contest is open only to residents of North America. Winners will be selected by blind drawing and notified by email before subsequent announcements through the participating podcasts, which just means, in complicated speak, we're going to tell you who won. Visit www.adventuresinscifipublishing.com and www.ishouldbewriting.com to find their episodes. If you're here from one of those podcasts listening to this one, hey, how are you? It's nice to meet you. We're glad to have you here. Thanks for stopping by. It was kind of nice. Would you like a glass of tea? Only 1 entry per person. And I think that's it. Speaking of that's it for us for this week. We will be taking a hiatus over the Independence Day holiday. So look for new episodes on the Thursday after the 4th of July. And then we'll be back here with another panel the following Monday. All the usual stuff, twitter.com/SFSignal. Follow John D. there. He tweets cool things. SFSignal.com for your daily dose of sci-fi goodness. And I'm over at twitter.com/ATFMB or functionalnerds.com or ATFMB.com. Usually some combination of all three. Voicemail line, 720-277-9082. Tell us what you think. Do it. You know you want to. I hope everyone has a safe and sane 4th of July weekend. Have a cheeseburger on me or a hot dog. But if you have a hot dog, here's the rules with hot dogs. Now, not everybody is aware of the rules with hot dogs, but I got to throw it out there. If you are older than 12, you're not allowed to put ketchup on your hot dog. That's an actual rule. Didn't know if you knew that or not. No ketchup on the hot dog if you're over 12. If you're under 12, you can put as much ketchup on your hot dog as you want. Over 12, mustard. Nah, see, this is the knowledge that I bring to you people. Anyway, I am out of here. Happy Independence Day, unless you're not American. And then, I don't know what you celebrate right now. Does Canada have the 4th of July? I think they do, because otherwise, how would they get from the 3rd to the 5th? Okay, I swear. I'm leaving now. Bye.